Welcome to the Latchkey Urchins and Friends podcast. I'm Allison Cibula.
And I'm Ann Sherry. We are healing trauma with humor, humility, authenticity, imperfection, messiness, and compassion.
Each week, we interview someone on a different childhood trauma and neglect topic. Our hope is to reduce the stigma of talking about mental health and offer some tools to heal.
Latchkey urchins are children who came home to an empty house after school each day and watched themselves. We are the children who fought viciously with our siblings. We set toasters on fire making cinnamon toast and aimlessly roamed the neighborhood hoping for something to do.
Urchins adapted to not need anyone. Our spiny prickly parts keep people at a distance.
Sometimes we were the kids other kids' parents warned you about.
Sometimes we were the kids who held it all together, saved our families, and got perfect grades in school.
Sometimes we were the teens who found comfort in drugs and alcohol.
Now, we are the adults who realize that our nurturance needs were not fully met, and we're healing that inner kid and breaking generational trauma.
So whether you're a latchkey, an urchin, or a friend,
you are wanted here. So good to see
Allison.
You.
Hi.
It's been a long, like, 3-4 months off.
It has.
Yeah.
It really, yeah.
It has. We've done a lot. Yeah.
Busy summer.
I'm super grateful for the break. You went to Nicaragua?
I went to Nicaragua. Yes.
For a month. Amazing.
Yes. It was definitely shakes up how you view stuff, for sure. I like to get out of, like, how we do things in America and the cult messages that come through. So it's a good, if you can, to get out.
If you're able to,
get a different perspective. Yeah.
So we are so excited to kick off season two with a really exciting interview with the amazing Susan Lin, who just released a book on September 13th with the New Press, Who's Raising the Kids? Big Tech, Big Business, and the Lives of Children. And this book explores the roots and consequences of the monumental shift towards a digitized, commercialized childhood. And so she explores digital technologies and the tech industry and kind of undermining what we know to be good for children's well-being. And we just loved talking to Susan. And I love that she was a ventriloquist on the Mr. Rogers show.
Yes.
That show raised me.
It felt like sitting with royalty a little bit, like somebody who actually worked with Fred Rogers. Yeah. And you can feel it on her. When we were reading her materials before we interviewed her, I was like, we're doomed. It's over.
Her book is amazing.
An insurmountable problem. Yes. And then after talking with her, I got that, like, Fred Rogers glow. Like, we can do this.
I know. She's the real deal.
Yeah.
You guys are going to love this interview with her. So, Anne, like, when it comes to, like, tech, commercialization of childhood, how do you relate to that?
I was thinking about, we were, because it was like the 80s is when it started, they really took the laws away and they started marketing to children.
Yes.
So I think that some of my TV, most of my binge TV was in the 70s. So maybe I was still a little protected. There was only 3 channels. But I also, you know, as much as we talk about the latchkey experience, we did go outside. We had to use our imaginations. And that's something that she's really talking about is missing now. I mean, we didn't have a ton of stuff. We'd go into the woods and build bike ramps and, you know, hurt ourselves. But we didn't take a bunch of pre-done toys that were telling us how to think, you know. So I'm appreciating that. And it's not great now. Like, you go into Target or everything is like all the imaginations, it's done. It's a complete product. You will, you know, even like the Legos and stuff, they're all that whole rise of like, you don't just get a tub of Legos now and just build stuff. You building
build an exact thing from a commercialized Star Wars ship.
And from a little book that says, put this thing here and this thing. Yeah. Yeah. So.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, we had one of our best toys as a kid. There were a few years, there was like a little recession in the early 90s where we just didn't have a ton of money in my family when I was like, you know, six, five, six, seven, eight, that, you know, range. And so that was great for our creativity because we couldn't buy the fancy stuff. And so my uncles all worked in construction. So my dad asked one of our uncles to make us wooden blocks out of leftover wood from the construction site. And this was our best toy. It cost $0. Awesome. It was a leftover wood that was going to be thrown away anyway. And we had these blocks. Yeah. We had so much fun with these blocks. And my dad was so good at actually playing with us. Like he's the kind of dad that like got on the floor, you know, wrestled around with us and like, you know, actually played. And so we would make these wooden block castles and then we would on like, you know, either side of the living room and then we would throw blocks over and try and like break down each other's castles. Like so fun.
Oh, and that became Minecraft, I think. That sounds like Minecraft or something. Yeah. Yeah, it's just that's interesting because I'm also wondering, you know, like how much is August getting or I don't know. When he was young, we were still living on the farm that's now an Airbnb. So he was outdoors a lot. He could run around and I don't know. There was a lot of chores to do. And since we moved in town and it's smaller and it's less, there is this like, it's hard to send kids out to play. They're kind of, they come home and they're stuck inside often, or I mean like, or their backyard or, you know, but this being able to roam, we're missing that. And I don't know what to even,
I know. I remember
it's all prescribed play. You're already like an amazing basketball player at second grade or something. I know, it's very comparative. Or what is your kid in and how many?
I call that. I used to do, you know, I worked in life coaching for a long time and I could really, really feel that from my coaching clients of that need to like prove themselves by like 22. Yeah. And I, at the time, this was before Britney Spears, like, you know, had major significant, whatever meltdowns publicly recently. But at the time I called it the Britney Spears effect because she was so, so, so famous by like 16, 15, 16, 17. And so I was I was like 14 when she was 16 or something like that. So we all grew up watching her and thinking I have to, you know, Mark Zuckerberg's another great, a great one because I think he was like, you know, in college when he created Facebook. And so for older millennials, we were watching these stars and it put so much pressure on us, you know?
Yeah. 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 I can remember, like, I don't think I can remember watching Madonna and Desperately Seeking Susan. Mm-hmm. And I was in Spartanburg and God, I don't remember when, early 80s.
Yeah.
And I so wanted to, we wanted to dress like her.
Yeah.
You could not find shit. Like, if you didn't live in New York, I think, like, it was impossible to find stuff. So
I'm Googling, though, when did Madonna get famous? How old was she? So she was 24. So that's what I'm trying to say is, like, it's really shifted. Where because of Nickelodeon and the Disney Channel is that we're watching these childhoods get ruined because now we're seeing that, right, with Britney Spears, is that you can't just take a kid's childhood and commercialize it. You cannot. Right. You will ruin this person. Like the young woman who just wrote the book that you've been reading. I'm glad my mom died.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the number one nonfiction book right now. It's resonating.
So good.
But Madonna, though, was 24 when she got big. But like, for my generation, we're seeing like Britney Spears. She was on the Mickey Mouse Club like when she was little. That's and then she was already being sexualized as a child, teenager. Yep. So that's damaging. That is damaging to kids. You know, I think it's one thing to watch Madonna when she's like 24 and, you know, continues to grow from there. But watching like child stars and then thinking you have to already be a success by 19 is bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Somehow and that's what then becomes the norm that kids are wanting to dress like or be like, and I don't even know what to say about Instagram or I think even Susan brings up that kid that has $1 million business on reviewing toys.
Oh, yeah. That I know. We'll put that in the show notes. That I've watched some of those. They're really weird to watch. And
yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think, I don't think that parents are, not every parent is like emotionally mature enough to realize like that putting their kid on the internet like that is probably not great.
Yeah.
What's that really, what's that example? Everyone's been talking about that recently. That little girl, do you know what I'm talking about? That little girl and her mom is like 20. And she's doing all these TikToks and some of them, and she's like a toddler and some of them are kind of suggestive. Like she kind of dresses her toddler up like a adult and she looks kind of sexy. And they're like, you guys, there's pedophiles on TikTok. Like, don't do that to your toddler
stuff or whatever. Maybe
Ren, that's her name. Ren Eleanor. Yeah. I went and looked at some of the videos and I'm disturbed. I am disturbed. Okay. But the mom is so young. I think she probably was a teen when she got pregnant. So that's the thing is like the mom does not have the maturity to understand what she's doing.
Wait a minute. This has like half a billion likes on some stuff and 17 million fans. I don't know where it's all going. I need to go play the interview.
So, Susan Lynn, everybody.
Susan. Just listen to Susan. Go back to Mr. Rogers.
She knows what's up. Enjoy.
Yes, completely.
We are so excited to be here with Susan Lynn. So Susan just had a book come out, Who's Raising the Kids? And we're so excited to talk to her about that book. And just a little bit about Susan. She's a psychologist, award-winning ventriloquist, and a world-renowned expert on creative play and the impact of media commercial marketing on children. She was the founding director campaign for a commercial-free childhood, now called Fair Play. Currently research associate at Boston Children's Hospital and lecturer on psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. The author of Consuming Kids, The Case for Make-Believe, and Who's Raising the Kids. We're so excited to have you here. Thanks for joining us, Susan.
I'm so happy to be here and talk with you.
Yay.
Before we ask you all the latchkey questions, can you tell our listeners just a little bit about your book that just came out?
It's called Who's Raising the Kids? Big Tech, Big Business, and the Lives of Children. And it's about how our digitized, commercialized culture affects children's values, relationships, and learning. And it's also about what we can do about it as a society and also in our own families.
That's so great.
It is so well timed. Everybody's lost right now. Yes, yes.
So were you a latchkey kid, which means kind of like were you left at home alone a lot? Were you an urchin, meaning like no feelings were discussed? Or are you a friend? And we can kind of roll that into, you know, what was the emotional environment of your childhood?
So my mother worked, which was actually unusual in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And so, and I don't have like terrible memories of, you know, coming home alone, except for one. I was a good kid. I, you know, always did well in school. And in third grade, I got my report card, and we had H's, S's, and U's, honors, satisfactory, unsatisfactory.
Okay,
and
okay.
I had all H's and a U in handwriting. I flunked handwriting in the
fourth grade. Interesting.
I was devastated, and I remember coming home, and my mother wasn't there. And I actually didn't have a key to the house. I usually went to a friend's house. And I just sat on the stoop crying, waiting for her to come home.
Was
it, it was the fear of disappointing her or being in trouble, do you remember?
I wasn't afraid of disappointing her. I was just devastated that I had failed at
school.
I know.
What was her reaction?
You know, it's funny. I don't remember her reaction.
So wasn't it maybe a big deal?
I remember seeing her come to the steps and being, you know, so relieved that she was home.
But Do you mind my asking, what did your mom do for work?
My mother was a pioneer in early childhood education in Michigan.
Wow.
Go, Mom. I'm loving your legacy. We have these things, this whole episode of legacy burdens. Yeah.
This is legacy strengths, legacy gifts.
And I'm like, oh, bring this legacy in.
Yeah.
I don't feel like her early childhood work was a burden. My parents were very, very left-wing politically. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, to the point that they were afraid that they were going to be arrested in the 1950s.
Got it. Okay. You know? That was the burden.
I'm proud of them, but that's a burden. But my mother's early childhood interest in early childhood, I think I really just benefited from that, actually.
That's so great.
It sounds like it.
We have been, or this has been a question for me as I study child trauma, is like, where are the kids that had the really good childhood? So Susan, thank you for being here.
Yay! Wait, who exists?
I'm not sure it was, I did not have a terrible childhood. I was not, abused, or anything like that. But, I was terrified of nuclear war. I had horrible dreams about that.
Okay. Oh, shoot.
And my parents were worried that they were going to be arrested. I mean, they made arrangements.
Oh, wow.
So there was a lot of fear in the house.
Trying to differentiate between, just the intersection of that, too, but the personal childhoods that went okay, but just culturally. Do you know the Elvis movie that just came out? And, so we're watching it with August, my 10-year-old, and the president was assassinated, his brother was assassinated, Martin Luther King was assassinated. You know, it was
stressful times.
Vietnam and So it's there's definitely that was going through the psyche of
people don't think that kids are affected by what's happening in the world around them. You know, they just don't think about it, but they are. I mean, there I was with, being afraid for my parents, afraid that I was going to be abandoned,
It's a lot. Yeah. So some fear. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for sharing that with us. Kind of the feeling in your household as a kid. So latchkey recipes, Susan, what did you make for yourself as a kid, food wise?
So my food memory is kind of backwards in a way. I was a younger sister, so it was my older sister who made lunch for us. At that time, we could go walk home for lunch. And so she was in charge of making lunch. And my sister loved Lipton's chicken noodle soup. And in my memory, we had Lipton's chicken noodle soup every single day. And the result of that is that I have never eaten it.
I remember that.
Never, ever. So, so that's my last.
It was so peppery, as I remember it.
Yeah. She thought so.
Wow, that's
like
so funny.
Lipton's
chicken noodle. It's like a packet that you add water to?
It's like a packet, wasn't it?
Pour hot water on it or in it.
I remember that. We had that too, Susan.
So
friendly. Not every day, I suspect. That same year, my mother was teaching way far out. I grew up in Detroit. She was teaching, way far out in the suburbs. It took her a really long time to get there. So my sister was in charge of lunch. My father was in charge of breakfast. And my father had very strong feelings about what you had for breakfast. And so what we had for breakfast, we had eggs. And we had soft-boiled eggs. As I remember it, practically every single day. And that's another thing. I've never had a soft-boiled egg since that year. So.
Oh, that's so interesting. You had your fill.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Susan. Those are fun childhood recipes. Not fun for you anymore, but thanks for those.
They're fun now.
So let's jump in and talking about all the fun things related to child neglect, tech, you know, kind of, you know, you've had a long career in childhood education and, you know, activism for really good childcare. So can you tell us a little bit more about your work and kind of what drew you to do this work?
Well, I began life as a ventriloquist. And I basically earned my living that way for a lot of my life. And I worked with Fred Rogers. You know, I was on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood and made videotapes with my puppets about difficult issues for kids. Did play therapy with puppets at Boston Children's Hospital, helping kids cope with having heart surgery, automobile accidents, having cancer, bone marrow transplants. Mm. So, you know, basically a lot of my work was about helping children talk about feelings through their play. And, you know, when we play, if we're really playing, you know, creatively, it becomes a safe space for expressing our feelings and for really telling the truth and being who we really are. So the well-being of children was always important to me. And then in the 1990s, I was raising my daughter and I was working with children at something that was called the Children's AIDS Program, and it was a daycare center for kids with HIV. So, mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, or maybe it was gradually, but I began to see the commercialization of children's lives.
Yeah, so you talk about in your book how, like, a main mission is to restrict a company's ability to market products for profit to children. And, you know, we really couldn't agree more. And in one episode with Ariana, we talked about sugary breakfast cereals for quite a long time and just how much those were marketed to children on TV. And, you know, before we started recording, you were telling us about latchkey kids. A lot of them are raised by TV. And I just remember seeing all these commercials on TV and I really wanted, you know, Lucky Charms. And I still have the Lucky Charms jingle, magically delicious, like from the commercial. Like this stuff gets in our heads for kids. So can you tell our listeners a little bit more about what you have found and kind of what you address in your book about why childhood is harmed by for-profit endeavors and marketing and products and all these sorts of things?
Yeah, you know, children are not adults in teeny tiny bodies. Right. Their brains are growing and developing. Their judgment, you know, as you know, both, you know, judgment doesn't really fully develop until, you know, we're in our 20s. And so they don't have the kind of judgment, they don't have the cognitive, you know, abilities to, you know, predict what's going to happen, to think about consequences. That's something that you acquire as you grow. And yet they have the same depth of emotions, you know, that we do. And so marketers work with child psychologists to exploit children's vulnerabilities in order to sell them stuff. And I think that, I mean, I believe, and you know, the kind of world that I want to live in is where children are valued and where the best interest, what's best for children, really takes precedence over pretty much everything else. And so, but if these huge, you know, conglomerates, the tech industry, they're not interested in the well-being of children. That's not their purpose. Their purpose, their primary purpose is to generate profit for their shareholders. Yeah. And so they make decisions that harm children. Like, for instance, like you know, you talked about sugary cereals on the show, and certainly childhood obesity is, you know, a problem.
It is.
But I think what's even a deeper problem is that marketing doesn't sell just sell products, it sells values and behaviors. And the primary value in all this marketing is that the things we buy will make us happy. You need the things that these companies are selling in order to be happy, successful, smart, you know, whatever. And at the same time, we're living, you know, in an age where the fate of the planet is really at stake. Yeah. And consumption is absolutely linked to global warming. And not only that, kids, so that's huge. So the idea that we're selling kids stuff all the time and telling them they need things when what we really need to do is cut back on consumption, I mean, that's a terrible travesty. But you know, on a more personal level, you know, kids who adopt materialistic values are actually less happy than their peers who have less materialistic values. So it's kind of a double.
Some great statistics on that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's studied and right there in numbers now. It's not working, you know.
No, it's
how did we get here, Susan?
What?
How did we get here? Why is this what we're doing with this one beautiful planet and our one beautiful lives? And
you know,
I can
actually answer some of that.
Please.
It goes the current age that we're in, the digital age, and the you know the primacy of these tech companies who have, by the way, the most powerful techniques ever for reaching all of us, including children, for keeping us glued online, for selling us things more than ever before. But it goes back to the beginning of television, when they, you know, they gave the spectrum, they gave it away for free, and allow companies to, you know, start advertising on television. And then in the 1970s, activists were trying to get advertising to children banned. And the Federal Trade Commission actually said that they were going to ban advertising to children under the age of 8 and ban junk food advertising to kids under the age of 12. This is before the childhood obesity epidemic.
There was so much
pressure on Congress that Congress actually defunded the FTC for a while, limited their ability to regulate marketing to kids. And then in 1984, Ronald Reagan deregulated the Federal Communications Commission. It became okay to make programs for the sole purpose of selling toys. And so that's And we have almost no regulation around marketing to kids, and certainly, you know, so far, just about none around the tech industry. Now, and so, you know, kids today are subjected to autoplay, you know, like on YouTube, where, you know, things just keep coming.
It just keeps going and going.
Or in games, leaderboards, where they can see who's winning, you know, and so that, you know, that keeps you on. Or push notices, which keep pulling you back, you know, to your devices. Yeah. Parents are subjected to them, and kids are subjected to them. And one harm that we don't really talk about is the, and that is relevant to your show, is the way that the tech industry comes between comes between parents and children.
Yeah.
And what the tech industry does is market things that they can do that are actually things that parents and caregivers used to do. That, you know, tech devices can read to your kids, they can tell stories to the kids, they can help kids with their homework. And so, you know, what they're getting or what they want is for kids to bond with their devices. And one particularly, like, I think something that we don't talk about a lot are our personal assistants, which seem, you know, like Alexa, mm-hmm. Amazon's Alexa.
Oh, yeah.
Which now kids can access Kids Alexa through something called the Echo Dot for Kids, which is this darling little tiger speaker.
That
and
does sound
so
cute.
It's so cute.
It sounds like Joe Cool with the cigarettes. Yeah, like when I was 18 or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah,
look at this cute camel and smoking. Yeah.
That's right. You know, I actually remember when my daughter was 2, we were at a shopping mall and there was a huge display of Joe Camel and she just headed right for it.
Right.
I mean, that's true, but you know.
This is abuse. I was looking through your stuff and I just circled bunches of stuff and I said, this, we are being abused. I mean, this is abuse. It's like a narcissistic parent or I don't know what
it is. But it feels...
Some personality disorder put it in, but it feels abusive.
It feels very on brand for American culture of kind of prioritizing greed.
Multi-level marketing.
You know, and I don't know if, Susan, you want to speak to that at all, but it just feels so on brand. Like, I just, the amount that we just love stuff, which, as you're saying, we just love to buy stuff. We've been taught that stuff will make us happy. And I'm so glad we have you on here because now I'm putting all the pieces together that television has been instrumental. And now, of course, you know, which has evolved into, like, these personal computers.
It is what raised you, the latchkey kids at... Yeah, the latchkey kids at home. I can remember us watching Tom and Jerry. I mean, we did go out and play kickball. We only had 3 or 12 channels. I can't remember. So we did get fed up. And that wasn't enough. They were like, oh, shit, the kids are going outside and playing kickball. We better get them back in. I guarantee you. Like, you know, yeah.
And that's really true. So, I mean, in Consuming Kids, I wrote about this and how the marketers... I mean, they really did think, wow, kids are home alone. Let's start targeting those kids.
Right.
And that was really the invention of tweens because it was, you know, the preteens mostly who were the ones who were home alone. I mean, older kids as well, but this was a new demographic.
Right.
We already felt like crap enough. Like, there's no emotional love in the household. So we were ripe for, I mean, it does feel, and I never know, is it like this thing that's just perpetuating itself or it has this sinister, is there who, you know, where there's a sinister quality to it, or maybe they don't think it's sinister. It's just a lack of emotional maturity as a culture. Like,
I think that, you know, I, as a country, and I think going back to the beginning, we valued freedom and personal responsibility, which are important, but we sometimes, or maybe often, value those two things above responsibility to the community, altruism, sharing, you know, those kinds of values. And so basically, you know, corporations, what it has been, and that might be changing, but what it has been, you know, for, you know, a long time is corporations can pretty much do anything they want and people just have to cope. And so in my world, the world of, you know, my concern about the commercialization of children's lives and kids being targeted, it's that corporations can, you know, market to kids and it's up to parents to cope. Parents should just say no. And, you know, that works so well for drug abuse. I mean...
Yeah, right. Just stop it.
And one thing, I mean, one of the most, you know, egregious things that companies do is encourage kids to nag their parents.
You called it, there were terms, pester power and nag factor.
That's right.
Those two, there's a bunch of terms that they, I mean, I cannot imagine sitting in a marketing meeting, like these are people probably that have children who go home and have their kids nagging on them. And you did that, like you created that.
I think that probably what they believe is that, you know, it's up to parents to protect kids. And I think they believe that they are protecting their kids, you know, until they find out that maybe they aren't. But the idea that we have a whole industry that A, wants to come between parents and children, and B, wants to encourage kids to, as a colleague of mine once said, make parents' lives absolutely miserable. I mean, that's, you know, it would be hysterically funny if it weren't so awful that it's really happening. And, you know, and it happens, you know, around the world.
And there are a few countries. Wasn't it Denmark or some of them?
Sweden.
Some country. Sweden or, yeah, Sweden said we're not doing this.
Yes, yeah. Sweden, the province of Quebec, they have laws about marketing to kids on television. But, you know, television seems a little quaint now. I mean, because
exactly.
Now, you know, it's online. Now, interestingly, what most young kids do online is watch television or they watch videos. So they've changed devices. Yeah. But the difference is that the way things are now, the device can know a lot about the child and so personally target advertising or programming you know, designed to exploit their vulnerabilities and to get them hooked on whatever it is they're doing. And, I started talking about the personal assistants. I bought an Echo Dot for kids just to see what, what it was like. And so, and I write about this. They have a feature that's called I'm Bored. So I said, was pretending to be a young kid. And I said, Alexa, I'm bored. And so what Alexa suggested to me were 5 games that were all based on national brands. And I did it again, and they're very poor. It was all based on that, Barbie, Wizarding World, which...
Oh, my God, it's Barbie. So sick.
I mean, so...
Yeah.
Well, and then I have a chapter about commercialism and racism and the way that racism can be embedded in commercialized culture, including there's been a lot about this in search engines. And so I woke up one morning and I thought, well, Alexa is kind of a search engine. So I went downstairs to my kitchen where the little cute tiger was sitting. And I said, Alexa, what are African-American girls? And it said, African-American girls are the fastest growing segment of the juvenile justice system.
That's what it said?
This is, yes.
Oh,
yes.
God.
I know. And then I said, what are African-American boys? And it was a little garbled, but essentially it said, There are boys, and many of them are struggling with learning and reading. And so, I know. And so this is from a company that is claiming to be able to help kids with homework. And you know, it's not as though parents and librarians and teachers, it's possible for them to pass on misinformation and racist views, but they can be held accountable in some way. And most parents, I mean, if you get one of these Echo Dots for kids do them alone because what the companies advertise, this is a way to keep your child occupied in a safe space
while you do
other things, you know, and...
So don't spend time together. And this is where I get kind of layered around this is I have, people, young moms in practice or even moms that are sort of regretting or dads as well, but they've lost trust in their ability. They're like, I'm doing it wrong. Like there's some way that there was this absolute right way to get enough tummy time. There's an anxiety that's like pervasive among parents, like, because it's coming externally. There's so little trust, like it's good enough. You know, if you spend time, so I'm, generally trying to get whatever, just find those trusting places. But also as a latchkey kid, becoming a parent, I would notice like boredom felt bad. And, you know, like, I like, I don't know, I sort of having kids was boring a little bit at times. And I was like, God, is this from, you know, like I was remembering having the Sears catalog. We would just circle stuff and like, and our list for Christmas would change based on a commercial. It was like scratch, 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 scratch. I don't want that. And Hungry Hippo made it to the top. I mean, it was the thing to get. And I got Hungry Hippo from Santa. I was over it in like 4 seconds. It's the stupidest game on the planet, but the marketers elevated it. So I don't know. I just going well, a little, I just all, reading your stuff, it was like, holy heck, there was so much more at play there, you know, than we're like, well, we had parents that weren't home. And it was like this evil, like, I don't know.
Well, let
I
can
just see this
ask,
image that was like,
let me, that kind of segues into a question that we had about the importance of kind of play, you know, and, you know, so Anne, you kind of touched on, well, it, parenting can be boring sometimes. And so I do kind of understand that maybe some parents are like, I can't do it anymore. Or, you know, and then we all, I mean, then we also have the problem where because no one can earn a living wage, you know, a lot of parents are working like 3 jobs. So if you could just hand your kid a tablet or whatever while you're not home, there's so many different issues. But optimally, I guess, Susan, what's kind of in what you found in the research optimally a great way for parents to engage with their kids and, you know, in the kind of like spontaneous play or maybe the importance of boredom or any of these themes?
Well, you asked about 732 questions.
I did. I'm so sorry. I want to hear them all. I do. We want to keep you on for hours.
You like I do, Susan. Just start talking and something.
Let me see. Well, first of all, having a young child, it's not it can be boring. It is boring at times.
It is. Thank you.
Thank you.
Me at times. Okay. You have to add at times.
I mean, and so that's one. And then, you know, now today we have our smartphones, which are constantly calling to us. It's like the sirens to Odysseus, you know, calling us. Come, I'll take you away, you know. And so, but what researchers have found is that they were observing parents at a playground. And what they noticed is that when parents were on their smartphones, they didn't respond when their kids were calling them. Unlike if they were doing something analog, like talking, you know, to other parents. But they were so engrossed, you know, they basically didn't hear or whatever, didn't hear their kids in some way or had just screened everything out but their device. And that when they did respond, they responded with irritation. And but the reverse is true. When toddlers are engaged, you know, with tech, it's harder to get them away than if they're playing with analog toys. And also, they also, you know, have tantrums when they have to get off. So, you know, basically, these devices are so powerful, and the techniques that companies use, you know, which are like in general persuasive design, you know, they're all there to keep us engaged, and also the devices are built for individual use. And so one problem, I mean, there are problems when parents, even ebooks, and, you know, the tech industry encourages parents to do ebooks with kids. Well, first of all, the bells and whistles on ebooks, all those moving things, actually prevent the kind of conversation that occurs when you're actually reading a book with kids that does promote literacy. But also, if you're reading with an ebook, parents don't snuggle with their kids. It's harder to snuggle with the kids with this device. It's harder to share.
Oh my gosh.
And so there's less of that there's less cuddling going on. And so, you know,
you just never thought about.
Yeah, so there's one thing, you know, that parents could do And that is, if you're taking kids to play and whatever, try not to bring your phone, or try not to put your phone on silent, bring a book. Or if you don't want to read, if you're good at crafts, then, you know, knit or sketch, mm-hmm. or do, mm-hmm. you know, do something else. So I don't think parents should feel guilty about being bored. But
I love it.
What is the case that being on the phone, first of all, models that behavior and makes the phone more desirable for your kids. But also, it's so engrossing and compelling that, you know, you don't want to respond with irritation when your kids are calling you. And nobody likes to be ignored, and kids don't like to be ignored. And one thing I describe in the book is I was walking through a park near my house, and there was a mother sitting on a park bench on her phone, and there was a toddler lugging an enormous branch. And so I just stopped to watch. So he's lugging. He goes, "Mom, Mom." And she goes, "Mm-hmm, mm-hmm." He goes, he gets closer. He goes, "Mom, Mom." And she goes, "Mm-hmm, mm-hmm." He gets right up to her. He goes, "Mom, Mom." And she goes, "Mm-hmm, mm-hmm." And he slugged her. He slugged her. So I don't believe in corporal punishment for parents or for kids.
Although, yeah,
yeah. My sympathies were with the child, but
yeah,
you don't have to give in to your child's request.
Yeah,
but it really helps if you acknowledge them, even if you're saying, "I hear you, but wait just a minute, I'm busy right now."
Yeah,
but
right.
So yeah, wow. I mean, it affects the kids, it affects the parents. But one other thing that I think it's really important is that this is a societal problem, and it needs to be fixed by society. And basically, it's a social justice issue, you know, and it's about the rights of children to grow up and the rights for parents to raise them without being undermined by greed. You know, we have that right. And that's why I and my colleagues back in 2000 founded Campaign for Commercial Free Childhood, which is now called Fair Play, and you can find it at fairplayforkids.org. But that's, you know, an activist organization, you know, taking on the biggest corporations in the world about how they're harming children.
100%. And it almost seems that too, like childcare goes into that, like reducing the stress that where parents have to be away from children a fair amount, or like, because I don't know, when you're in that those really frazzled areas, you're like, fine, just take the device. And so, but
and also,
structurally, in many ways, that this has been going in the wrong direction. And there was that one movie too, just quickly, what was the movie that was calling out the social media, the social something.
Oh, the social network.
Social network. And all the, it was just, I'm was that sure what it was called?
No.
All the ones that were, it was a documentary.
I know.
Anyways, the ones that, the people that have brought forth this technology do not let their children use it. They were clear. Like, this stuff is dangerous and awful.
Dilemma.
And I don't let
social
my kids
dilemma.
Use it. And I
was like, some of them, anyway.
The social dilemma. Right, sorry.
The social dilemma, that's
anyway,
right.
And find
the
that kind of interesting.
Center for Humane Technology did that.
Yeah, so
they put that one out. Yeah, it's a good documentary.
What are some, you've mentioned a couple solutions.
More solutions?
Knitting, you know, picking an activity, which you're already inspiring. I don't even have kids. And I'm like, oh, gosh, I could do some non-tech hobbies. That sounds good. What are some other solutions and kind of like optimally? Well, optimally, what kind of world are you looking to create?
Okay. Well, I'm looking to create a world, as I said, where children are valued, and where we understand that children are not adults, but they are human beings. And also where we understand that childhood experiences, as you two both know, you know, affect you for the rest of your life. Yes. I mean,
yes.
Values and behaviors and the way we see the world, the way we relate to other people all go back, you know, to childhood. And where being human means something. And one of the things, and human relationships matter. And so one of the things that's happening is we're living in a world where technology is only going to get more and more and more seductive, more creative. Yes. I mean, yes. You know, the metaverse, which is going to be so powerful and also filled with advertising and run by corporations. And so we really need to have a world where children learn to value life, that you learn to value human life, they learn to value nature, they learn to value, you know, what's, you know, going on around them. And when I said this is a societal, problem, I mean, I've been doing this advocacy work for over 20 years.
Yeah.
And for the first time, there actually are bills in Congress that have made it out of committee and are supposed, you know, hopefully going to be voted on, that address, that actually do, are trying to set limits on the tech industry and the techniques they use to exploit children. So that's, you know, that's encouraging. Whether these bills get through, whether they pass, whether they get watered down, all of that, you know, is an unknown. But the fact that they're actually there, I think, just really, really important and hopeful.
And so what can we...
story of hope.
Yeah. What can we do, like, for our listeners who want to get involved in this movement, what's... Mm-hmm. What can parents do? What can activists do?
Okay. So one thing, go to fairplayforkids.org. They have all sorts of things, you know, that people can do. And they have a Screen Time Action Network, you know, that helps people who want to do something about excessive screen time. You know, if you want to change things on a national level, you're not going to do that alone. I mean, that's why we started Fair Play, because we needed a national organization that would take on this issue. So that is one thing. And for parents, first of all, stop feeling guilty. That doesn't help you. It's hard to be a parent. We live in a society that doesn't support parents. There was just an article in the New York Times today about how parents are having troubles getting kids into after school care because there aren't enough after school teachers, and you know they're full. And don't support
that
parents and kids. So all of that is real. So in that context, try to limit your own time with technology.
Yeah, that's a good call.
Wear a dumb watch. Don't get a smart watch. If you have a smart watch, don't wear it when you're around your kids, because that's just going to pull you in because of all the things that you can do. And for goodness sake, don't get a smart watch for your young child. They're pushing those on kids now. So you don't want, you know, you don't want to be able to see emails and do texting on something you're wearing. And the other thing is, don't rely on your smartphone to tell you what time it is. I did that. I got a smartphone. I thought, I don't need to wear a watch. And then I noticed every time I looked to see what time it was, I checked my email. I did other things.
Yeah.
That's the brilliance. The diabolical brilliance of having everything in one device.
Flashlight, so, calculator.
And then especially, you know, with babies and toddlers, except for, you know, video chatting with adults who are far away, who love them, there's no benefit to babies and toddlers to be on a screen, really. So, you know, when you're thinking about toys, get toys that are open-ended. As the saying goes, the best toys are 90% child and only 10%
yes,
toys.
Yes, yes.
Toys. The best toys just lie there until, you know, you do something to make them into something or transform them. And yeah. The best-selling toys are toys that look good in an ad. And so, but they're the toys that are often, you know, linked to media characters, linked to online stuff that really diminish instead of encourage children's yes. creativity. So, yeah. And the idea that young kids have to get on online, they have to use devices to prepare them for jobs in the future. Well, that's ridiculous because first of all, as one tech guy said, you know, we make these devices for people who are brain dead. I mean, they're so easy to use, but also the technology is going to change. We're already shifting to voice. So, you know, swiping and tapping and all of that, that's not going to be helpful to your child. What your child is going to need, your children are going to need experiences with creativity, with generating ideas, with cooperation, with follow through, with you know, being able to take initiative and see something through to the end. They're not going to get that from a device.
That sounds like all the things we're going to need to solve climate crisis.
Well, like, that's certainly true.
To talk with each other, to have ideas, to, you know, yeah.
Yeah.
To see things through to the end, to persevere.
Right.
Well, yeah.
To learn that we don't need things to be happy.
I just so appreciate everything that you said about helping us get to a more human-centered society and culture. It's just so needed. Yeah. Everyone, go buy Susan's book. We'll put the link in the show notes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
one big question we always do, Susan, is that why can't we care? And why do we care about each other? Why do we care about anything in some ways? And you have provided an enormous answer.
Yeah.
A big block of
you have. This is huge for we
really
keep coming back to this.
Be treated that way.
Why can't we care? Oh, because of marketing and programmed from a young age, you know, and it just gets in there. I'm really blown away, you know, wow.
And ourselves.
Of how my childhood due to TV indoctrinated me to want things.
And it doesn't have to be this way.
That's right.
We created this environment. We can change this environment. It's just, it's not going to come easy. It's not going to come from the top down. It's going to come from the bottom up.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, feelings wheel time. So this is a game that we play. It's feelings wheel.
Susan needs to go. Yeah, right.
It's feelings wheel time. So this is a game where we each pick a feeling, I will pick a feeling for you randomly, and then you just share when you felt that feeling. And you know what I'm going to do, Anne? I'm going to have you go first.
Yeah.
I'm going to have you go first, model it for Susan.
And where it is in your body. This embodiment.
We
know that embodiment helps feelings be deeper, I think. So we kind of try to find it in or around our bodies, Susan.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, okay, I have a feelings wheel, feelingswheel.com in front of me, and I'm just got my finger going around, and Anne, you tell me when to stop.
Okay, stop.
Oh, gosh. I'm so sorry, Anne. Despair.
Now.
Tell me more.
Preparing to talk with Susan. Yeah. Okay, hang on.
Let me like.
No. Well, you are very courageously bringing forth this, but there is a quality of despair. I'll just use that. Like immediately I can feel tears behind my eyes. I can feel stuff in my chest, kind of like just almost a nervous bubbly-ish, like, oh, this is scary. You know, it feels a little scary. Mm. So is that despair?
That's perfect.
Yeah, I'm going to go with despair. I can feel the hope over here too, because Susan, like, you're very inspiring and hopeful, but I am a big believer in We have to feel it for it to be real. So to feel the despair of what this mess that we're in.
Then we can solve it.
Yeah, that I'm going to pause a little bit and just that makes me know it actually is real rather than like, oh, I wonder what's on sale on Amazon, you know, because I don't want to feel it. But yeah, so there's some grief. Yeah, so that. But I'm like, I can feel hope over here, but I'm just going to be like, no, 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 stay with how big this actually is. It really is big. It's not a small problem. Yeah,
it's big, but it's not insolvable, unsolvable.
I am so grateful to speak with you today. Yeah.
Okay. So I'll go next, and then Susan will go. So Anne, why don't you tell me when to stop?
Okay.
Okay, despair. I got.
Did you get despair?
I got confused. So lately I've been feeling really confused about the current state of work because I left my job in March and I started diligently applying in July for new jobs. So I've had 2 months. I've applied for about 35 jobs, and I've had five of those companies said, yes, we want to interview you. And they've been really, really, really very confusing, more so than any time in history. So I know that there's like burnout. Employees are more burned out than ever about COVID, especially because I work in the healthcare field. So I'm getting like a lot of like, sorry, I didn't follow up on this. Like a lot of those, a lot more than usual, like some ghosting, people who work for major US universities, like ghosting, like not showing up to the interview and not rescheduling, not even emailing me, just not showing up. This has happened multiple times. A well-respected university. So I'm very confused about what's going on. It's unprecedented for me, trying to get a job. And, so confused. It's confused is like a little bit more of a heady kind of thinking. I think it's less in the body. It's more like in like just it disembodied, I think. Because when I really actually sit with the embodiment, there's more sadness there. There's actually just more sadness. So it's interesting. I think confused is almost like a overlayer of some deeper, like some frustration, some sadness. Yeah. And so the frustration and sadness really feels like my body gets kind of tight. My fists kind of clench a little bit, but then the sadness is more in my chest. So that's confused. So Susan, okay. I'm going to just kind of go around the feelings wheel. And so you tell me when to stop, and that's your feeling.
Okay. Stop.
Disappointed.
Disappointed. Wow. I guess that I'm disappointed that people don't understand the importance of taking care of children. I'm more than that also. I'm more than disappointed, but yes. It is disappointing that they don't understand how valuable not just their children are, but other people's children. And I'm disappointed that people when people don't understand the importance of caring about, as I said before, other people's children. And I think that disappointment, it's in my shoulders and my back.
Got it.
It's not an activating feeling. It's kind of a feeling.
Got it.
So, yeah. And I think
I really
that,
feel
like,
that.
And I think that like confusion, you know, it's the top layer of anger and fear and deeper and more volatile emotions. It's kind of like a top layer of that, or it tamps them down.
And I really can feel that. Well, Susan, thank you so much for coming on and telling us all about your work and your new book, Who's Raising the Kids? Big Tech, Big Business, and the Lives of Children. I love it. But you know, thank you for helping us think about how to care about kids, how to have a more human-centered society and culture where instead of thinking about buying things, we're thinking about valuing each other. This is just exactly the kind of conversations that we're wanting to have. And gosh, like you have such eloquence and wisdom. Thank you so, so freaking much.
Yes, thank you very much,
thank
Susan.
Thank you, both of you. It's been great talking to you.
Thanks for listening to Latchkey Urchins and Friends. If you like what you heard, follow, subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts, but especially Spotify and Apple. And if you didn't like it, just go ahead and hold that in, just like you've been doing since childhood. Just kidding. We love hearing feedback. Please visit us online at latchkeyurchins.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. This podcast is produced by Allison Sabula and Anne Sherry. Episodes are edited by me, Allison. They're audio mastered by Josh Collins, and our theme music is by Proxima Parada.